So today, I'm very, very happy to have Doug Nover back here in the series. Doug did a presentation a few years back, and he can tell you that I have been almost like stalking him to make sure that he would do this presentation. Doug is one of the major lights on this campus in relation to the study of popular culture and has been one of the top people nationwide in that association, Popular Culture Association. So it's great that Doug is with us today. He's actually a professor over in Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures. He's past department chair there and has done a variety of different administrative slots here on campus, as well as being a first-rate scholar. So today, he's going to be really looking at two films that many of us have probably seen, Ron Howard's Far and Away and Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York. I have to tell you that the Gangs of New York is one of my absolute favorite films, thinking that it invokes that period in American history probably better than anything that I can think of in terms of the popular screen. And I hope I'm not stealing Doug's thunder by saying that. So Doug is going to be talking on two versions and visions of Irish immigrant history, Ron Howard's Far and Away and Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York. So please help me in welcoming Doug Nover.
Thanks, John. I'm interested in how feature films, popular feature films, feature history, and what they convey about American history in their own particular way. I think sometimes the reviewers and the critics want them to do more than they've committed themselves to do, and so it's a dangerous territory for a filmmaker to go into, because there are a lot of historians out there waiting to find every fault that they can with the film. This was certainly true with the Scorsese film, Gangs of New York, and people found things there. But what I want to do is three things. First, I want to discuss these two films as personal projects of the directors, Ron Howard and Martin Scorsese, and talk about how some of the personal elements, their personal involvement in these films, shaped these films in the way that they did. This is absolutely essential to understand the two films. Secondly, I want to look at how the films use Irish-American immigrant history and how they frame that history, or that part of that history, in particular time sets. Far and Away opens in Western Ireland in Galway, County Galway, in 1892, and concludes the day of the Cherokee Strip land rush in Oklahoma, which takes place on September the 16th, 1893. I'm sorry, it should be 1893. It opens in 1892 and finishes in 1893. This was the sixth of a series of land rushes in Oklahoma. And it was the one that involved the most land, the most available land. I'll talk about that in more detail. And I gave you a little map there, which the Cherokee Strip is right across the top of the map of Indian Territory. And then there's a detailed map down below, which actually shows the strip itself. And I'll talk about how this figures in the concluding sequence in the film. So there had been other land rushes. There was one more left to be done, and then it was over. And the land rushes were in Oklahoma were very different from the homestead, from homesteading. The land rushes, the land was not free. You had to purchase the land. You had to pay for it per acre. Depending on the quality of the land, it ranged from $1 an acre up to $2.50 an acre. These land rushes were money-making propositions because the federal government had to pay the Native American tribes for the land. So in a sense, they were generating the revenues that were necessary in order to pay the tribes for the land that they gave up. Then Scorsese's film, Gangs of New York, of course, has two time frames. One, the first time frame is 1846, and this is a battle between the nativist gangs, the nativist organization, and the Irish. The Irish gangs led by the Dead Rabbits, but also shoulder to shoulder with other Irish gangs of New York City. And this is the opening 1846 part is where the main character, Amsterdam Balon, where his father is killed by Bill the Butcher Cutting. Then there's a break where he goes off to he's sent to a reform school, and he comes back a young man, and basically it's a story of getting revenge against Cutting for having killed his father in this fight in 1846. So the second part of the film is probably some of 1862, and then finishes up the main part of the story finishes up on during the time period of the New York City draft riots, July 13, 14, 15, and 16 in 1863. And what Scorsese does is basically to, and I think probably what they didn't understand was he conflated the 4 days into one. And that throws off some things, I think, as I'll talk about in the end, because each day was different. Each of the 4 days was different. I'll talk about that as well. And then third, I want to focus on the film's use of class separations and class antagonisms, and how these are presented as a historical driving force, and how underneath these surging forces, these surging historical, social, economic forces, there's a love story in each of the films to provide a human scale. So let's remember, Far and Away is not the famine generation, the great Irish famine generation of immigrants coming to the United States, fleeing destitution and fleeing starvation. But this is a group coming out of Ireland, out of what was called the Land War of 1879 to 1882. And that's exactly what it was. It was a war about land. It was a war about, because Ireland had basically a system of land renters, people. There were a lot of different arrangements that you could have, but basically, you did not own title to the land. You did not hold title to the land, and whatever tenancy you had on that land could be terminated by the owner of the land. At his discretion or at his decision. So in this period of time, the issue, of course, was whether there was a big debate. It raged in the United States as well as in Ireland, a big debate about whether these peasants, these Irish peasants, these lower class farmers, in fact could have outright ownership of the land as opposed to renting. Henry George, the well-known economist and social theorist, wrote a very important book that in fact contributed to the to this land war and to the debate, called The Irish Land Question, published in 1881. And George argued that it wasn't the presence of the British in Ireland so much as it was private property ownership was the problem, and too few people owning that private property. George became so interested in Ireland that he went and spent a year there during this time period. So those are the three things I want to talk about. Now, in terms of the production history, let me talk a little bit about Far and Away and Howard's personal connection to this film. This was Ron Howard's ninth film. You may remember he left Happy Days and decided he was going to be a film director. And of course, the people on Happy Days were devastated. But he began a career. This is his ninth film. It cost $600 million to make before marketing costs. It did $58 million in domestic sales, grosses, and $130 million worldwide. Thank God for the worldwide market for a lot of films, because many directors have been saved by other markets. I'll talk about that in connection with Scorsese. Ron Howard was born in Duncan, Oklahoma, in 1954. He spent his first 4 years in Duncan before his parents took him to the West Coast, to California, to be a child actor. Both of his parents were actors themselves. And three of Ron Howard's family members had ridden in the 1893 Oklahoma land rush. Three of them. Including Ron Howard's great grandfathers. So he started out thinking that he'd like to do a story about his great grandparents and their well known love affair, which had been talked about in the family. And a funny thing happened on the way to the to doing that story. So he went to Ireland. He took a trip to Ireland with Bob Dolman and Brian Glazer, who was a co-producer, and Dolman wrote the script. They came back, and of course, some interesting things happened. First of all, they signed Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise to the major roles in the film. Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, of course, had become an item working together in the film Days of Thunder, which is a film about NASCAR racing. And so they were a hot item. They hadn't married yet. They were dating. And so this produced a lot of buzz about this film before it even came out. Both of them had Irish background. But it was Nicole Kidman who had the real genuine Irish background. Her great-great-great-grandparents came from Ireland and settled in Sydney in 1842. So she was genuine Irish. And that's played up very well in the film. She was 24 at the time, and Cruz was 29. They had to, of course, they're playing younger parts. Secondly, the person who Michael Solomon, who had shot the film Backdraft, which is a very good film about firefighting and firefighters, he said that he wanted to make this film in 70 millimeter and not 35 millimeter. Widescreen, big production. Nobody had done a film in 70 millimeter since 1970. So it was almost, it was over 20 years ago that anybody had even used the widescreen format. It was, but it was possible to do it because of some equipment improvements. So there was that. Big screen, widescreen format. Ron Howard said, okay, let's shoot it that way. Then they had to find somebody to do the musical score for it. They ended up with John Williams. And John Williams, by this time in his career in Hollywood, as a composer, as a writer of scores for films, he had already gained 4 Academy Awards by the time he worked on this film. You probably remember his work for Star Wars and E.T. So in other words, we've got an interesting collection of things coming together here. You know, they've got a story, and then Ron Howard decides, we got to finish this thing with the Oklahoma Land Rush, the 1893 Cherokee Strip Oklahoma Land Rush. This is going to be big, right? For that, he had to have 800 expert riders, 200 horse and wagon teams, 9 cameras, 1 in a helicopter, and several buried in the ground to capture the action. And on top of this, he had to worry about his father. His father, Rance Howard, told his son, look, those are my ancestors that rode in that 1893 Cherokee Strip Land Rush. I got to ride in it too. I want to be in that sequence in the worst possible way. Now, if his son had, his father at that time was 63 years old, but an expert horseback rider, and he wanted to recreate family history, and his son decided, okay, I'm going to be as nervous as a cat, and he was, hoping that his father didn't have an accident, fall off a horse or whatever. And when they shot this sequence, this land rush sequence, it took 5 takes. They did 5 different takes of the Oklahoma land rush sequence. And his father survived every one of them. And without a scratch, they filmed it outside of Billings, Montana. So what started out as a small-scale love story, which was the original idea, took on the dimensions of a large-scale epic historical film with really big-name talent and a lot of buzz around this film. In Gangs of New York, Scorsese ran up the tab on this film. The film cost over $100 million to make. It did a box office in Canada and the U.S. of about $77.8 million. Did very well in Japan, $23.7 million in Japan, $16.4 million in the U.K. Worldwide took in grossed $194 million. The fights between Scorsese as director and the producer Harvey Weinstein became this daily talk, and basically it had to do, the fight that they had was over the final cut of the film. How long would it be? Scorsese wanted a film that ran over 3 hours. Weinstein wanted a shorter two hour and 45 minute film. They had a much more difficult thing to do historically, because basically they had to recreate the Five Points area of New York, the infamous Five Points, plus all the surrounding area, the streets leading into the Five Points, plus have some ships in the harbor. They had so the production designer recreated over a mile of mid-century New York buildings. The five-block area of Lower Manhattan, including the Five Points slum, sections of the East River waterfront with two full-size sailing ships, a 30-building stretch of Lower Broadway, including an upper-class mansion, replicas of Tammany Hall, which is very nicely done in the film, a church, a saloon, the Chinese theater. He got caught on that one because the Chinese didn't come in until a little later. And these were all done at a studio in Italy, in Rome, Italy. That's where they built this set. Phenomenal. But the problem was, as the film went on and it took more and more time to work on it, these actors had other contracts. So they were in and out, and everybody was having some difficult time. But it finally got done. Scorsese is a meticulous individual, meticulous in every detail, and they announced the release of the film, and of course it wasn't released, and then they blamed 9/11, or gave 9/11 as an excuse, because in the last sequence of the film, as you'll see, the World Trade Center is featured prominently in it. They thought it was too close. So anyway, the origin, I talked about the origin of the concept for Far and Away. The origin of the concept for Gangs of New York was Martin Scorsese grew up in the Little Italy section. His parents were first-generation immigrants to this country. They both worked in the garment district in Manhattan, Lower Manhattan. But they were also both actors, just like Ron Howard's parents were actors, but they did something else primarily. Scorsese was raised in a very devout Catholic culture, and for a time he considered becoming a priest. He was a very observant individual, and walking around New York City in his neighborhood and in New York, he observed that there were vestiges of a past that he did not know or did not understand. In fact, he didn't even know that it existed. But there was enough evidence there. Tombstones from the early 1800s at the St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, the one on Mulberry, cobblestone streets in some places, nooks and crannies that in a modern day city wouldn't be tolerated. They would be considered unnecessary. Unusual intersections of streets, stone basements that didn't seem to make any sense. So he became interested in the people who had been there before his parents' wave of immigrants came from Sicily. And what he found out, of course, was that the modern city had not completely erased the past. And gangs of New York can be seen as a kind of social archaeology of the past, an uncovering of place, society, and its peoples, where the urban scene exhibited and was run by different codes, different social codes, different rules of survival, different social alliances, different values about life and death, different expressions of power, which were much more physical and much more individual. In 1970, Scorsese read Herbert Asbury's book, The Gangs of New York, An Informal History of the Underworld, which was originally published in 1928. And in 1979, he acquired the rights to Asbury's book, but it took quite a while before he was in any kind of a position as a director or had any kind of financial connections to try and do anything with the concept that he took from the book. He had what he believed was a great story. New York City in the throes of trying to become an organized and settled city during a time of heavy Irish immigration, growing class strife, and a civil war making its impact on New York, in a period where gangs ruled the streets at night and fought other gangs for territory or for domination or for control of illegal activities. There were a lot of reasons why these gangs clashed, and a lot of them were economic. It wasn't just because they necessarily hated each other based on, long-standing grievances. Scorsese chose to focus on the rivalry and the hatred between the nativists and the Irish. If you read Asbury's book, The Gangs of New York, that would have been far too complicated story to tell. He needed a focus for it. So basically what he did was he took all the Irish gangs when they come together to fight the nativists. The nativists don't want them there. These are the know-nothings. And of course, they're fighting tooth and nail against them. The other Irish gangs are there, and they're referred to. We learn their names, and we see some of the faces. But basically, they're only there when they come together with the dead rabbits to fight the nativists. The battle then has to do with whether tribal antagonisms and hatreds can be worked out, whether a semblance of a democracy with citizenship develops, whether such an amalgamation of various peoples, backgrounds, ethnicities, and faiths can become relatively peaceful and stable. In other words, a modern city with necessary accommodations in and among groups, in and among peoples, that is necessary for a modern city to work, so that it's not just constantly hit with problems, unrest, riots, and so forth. This is what Scorsese said about his story, quoting him. "The country was up for grabs, and New York was a powder keg. This was the America not of the West, with its open spaces, but of claustrophobia, where everyone was crushed together. On the one hand, you had the first great wave of immigration, the Irish, who were Catholic, spoke Gaelic, and owed allegiance to the Vatican. On the other hand, there were the nativists, who felt that they were the ones who had fought and bled and died for this nation, cutting his father was killed in the War of 1812 against the British. He says, they looked at the Irish coming off the boats and said, what are they doing here? It was chaos, tribal chaos. Gradually, there was a street by street, block by block, working out of democracy as people learned somehow to live together. If democracy didn't happen in New York, it wasn't going to happen anywhere. It's a view of American history. And it's probably something that, you know, if you read American history texts, you're going to find this kind of smoothed over. But this is the story that he wanted to tell, and it came out of the fact that he learned that his little Italy Italian neighborhood was not the first immigrant neighborhood, and that the others had been there before, and that there were natives in the sense of native-born Americans who existed there as well, and there were antagonisms between the two groups. So in these stories, we have a lot of very American themes. In Far and Away, of course, we have the theme of the dream of land and the power of that dream, the compelling power of that dream, especially for those who were landless, for those who, in fact, had been victimized by being unable to own land. At the beginning of Far and Away, Donnelly's father dies, and the landowner decides, well, the three sons aren't going to do a good job on this farm. I'm going to take the land back. And so during the father's funeral, they send a guy back to burn the house down. While the man is being buried, the house is burned to the ground, and they're told that they've been evicted. And there's nothing that they can do about it. They have no legal recourse. His father has sort of given Joseph because he noticed that Joseph had a feeling for the land, that he had an attachment to the land that his older brothers did not. And so he, on his deathbed, he says to Joseph, without land, a man is nothing. Land is a man's own soul. So this is, while Joseph forgets about this at times, it's always in the background of his mind, this belief that there's a personal destiny for him that somehow involves land that he will own, not that someone else's owns, not that he has to pay any rent on, but he will own it outright, and he will shape that land into an image of himself. You know, it's the old Jeffersonian dream. The young woman in the film, Shannon Christie, who's a privileged daughter of a landowner, she wants the freedom to raise horses and to be able to ride them the way that she wants to be able to ride them. That's her dream of freedom, her dream of individual freedom, personal freedom, is to raise horses and be able to ride those horses, not side saddle, but the way that she rides them in the rides her horse in the final sequence of the film. In the story, Tom Cruise's character Joseph Donnelly goes through like every role that an Irishman would take in America. He starts out as a boxer fighting for Mike Kelly's social club and becomes a kind of Irish hope. And they really played up showing Cruise's physicality and you know, being very athletic and being very strong. He was a worker in a factory producing chickens for market, which is where Shannon also works. He takes off and becomes a railroad laborer working on a track laying gang for a transcontinental railroad. And then, of course, he becomes an aspiring land seeker in the Oklahoma Territory. This was important for Ron Howard to tell this story about, because most of the stories about Irish immigrants are about cities, about the urban experience. About a third of the people, the Irish who came in that 1870 and 1880 and 1890 period, about a third of them went to the frontier. They went to lands in Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nebraska. They went to be agriculturalists. They went to be farmers. So that was important for Cruise that story be told. The Dakotas, and of course, Oklahoma. In Gangs of New York, I'll just mention, I've already talked about the early turbulent history of New York City, the corruption, the alliances, the use of new voters by Tammany Hall, the delivery of votes, the payoffs, the grafts. That's an important part. But there are two others, and this is where Amsterdam Vallon comes in, and that is the theme of the developing city as a furnace or as a crucible. A place where war chiefs and tribes struggled against each other. So you had the wealthy, the Schemmerhorns, and the Fifth Avenue group, Tammany Hall, boss William Tweed, the nativists, the police and the fire companies, the fire brigades, the immigrant gangs, the newspaper people, Horace Greeley. You know, one part of that riot, that draft riot that took place, was against the newspapers and against the newspaper editors. Greeley barely escaped with his life in the draft riots, and there were actual attacks against the newspaper offices. I think at the Tribune they ran up. They had a Gatling gun that they kept them off with. Then we see something else in the film too, and that is the Irish is finally coming to a realization of their potential power. Rather than giving in to these ancient feuds, ancient blood feuds, and just scrapping and struggling for an existence, if they found a way to come together, something would happen. And this happens in the film in two ways. One, the power and strength that they realize in their Catholic faith. On the occasion of the Irish defending their church from being ransacked and burned by the nativists, This was actually pulled from an earlier period of time when the nativists came after St. Patrick's Old Cathedral on Mulberry Street in 1836. And they actually cut holes in the church. The guys in the church cut holes in the church, and they shot their rifles out of the these notches in the holes of the church. Amsterdam says in a voiceover, quote, "The earth turns, but we don't feel it move. Then one night you look up, one spark and the whole sky's on fire. The past is the torch that lights our way. Where our fathers have shown us the path, we shall follow. Our faith is the weapon most feared by our enemies." Archbishop John Hughes comes to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Irish in this confrontation over the church, and we have one in the film. Secondly, was the power and strength that came from political organizing. In the film, they make an alliance with Boss Tweed and Tammany Hall to get Monk McGinn elected sheriff. Monk who dies at the hand of Cutting in the film. I think it was the day of his election, or maybe the day after his election. He realizes, and he's been in all these bloody fighting. He says to Amsterdam in the film, quote, "My father was killed in battle too, in Ireland, in the streets, fighting those who would take as their privilege what could only be gotten in hands by the decimation of a race. That war is 1,000 years old and more. We never expected it to follow us here. It didn't. It was waiting for us when we landed." And so in a sense, something that they didn't anticipate actually happens. That is, these antagonisms, which now are coming from another set of people, from another group of people, and being pushed at them in violent, vehement, degrading ways, this is what they've come up against. And so they have to come together. From 1872 on, not too long after the time of the film, Tammany had an Irish boss. So they actually took control of Tammany Hall, which of course under Tweed had exploited the Irish vote and used the Irish vote for its purposes, and they get the mayor's office become, of course, a major political force in New York City. Okay, I think I want to show the sequence. I hope we've got it set up right. Hit play, right? How about this sound?
Fire!
see how the widescreen format really works in this sequence. There are the Native Americans.
No wish to fight.
You don't allow him to scare us off. This is her parents.
Lord, protect us, Daniel! Here they come!
And they're showing the example of the Sooners.
Stand by, Buckner, and pretend you're out of breath.
Pretend?
But as they got out, found the plot that they wanted ahead of the everybody coming in.
Oh my God,
in the rush, and you'll notice she's running the horses around to make it look as if the horses are tired from having made a long ride. So that's the land rush sequence that took five takes, and Ron Howard's father surviving all five of them. This Cherokee Strip land run on September the 16th, 1893, was the largest land run in U.S. history, opening up nearly 7 million acres to settlement. There were 42,000 parcels available. They purchased the land from the Cherokees for $7 million. And 115,000 people registered for the run. And as you can see from the map that I gave you, they could come either from the north or the south, but they couldn't come from the east or the west into the strip. And they had to enter from one of these designated entry points. And then there were three land offices where they would go to register their claim according to the number that was on it. So they paid a $14 registration fee. They had to be the head of a family or 21 years old, man or woman. They had to be a U.S. citizen to get a final patent for the piece of land for the 160 acres. And, of course, Native Americans were not allowed in the race, in the run. They were not citizens, and, of course, they were the ones who had sold the land. So what we see at the end of the film is, of course, this big moment when Joseph finally claims his piece of the land, plants his flag. Shannon abandons this aristocrat that worked for her father, and so it ends on this glorious high note. We know historically that about anywhere between 20 and 30% of those succeeded. It was a very low percentage, even lower than Homestead Act. You had to have money. You had to pay a $14 registration fee, and you had to pay a dollar to $2.50. I would think that river bottom land would have gone for $2.50 an acre, and 160 times $2.50 plus a registration fee just to be in the land rush, in the run, of course, meant that you had to have cash. All right, let's see if we can look at just the last. I want to do the. All right. All I want to go ahead to the last. The dead rabbit.
How many other men live here? You all have to register.
You can't force me to join Noah.
This is the beginning of the draft riot. This is the ritualistic confrontation of the Irish gangs, the Dead Rabbits. And what's happening here, of course, is this is, I think, a very interesting conclusion to this story. We have these nativists and the Irish fighting out an old blood feud. They claim, you know, this is tribal. A challenge was issued and accepted. They agreed upon the weapons that would be used in the battle. They agreed upon a place that they would fight each other. They agreed upon an outcome that if such and such side won, then the outcome would be that the rest of the people would be... Their gangs would be banished forever. But what happens, of course, is that this gets interrupted by a larger battle that's going on, which is the battle for New York City. The battle between the federal troops and the militia and the police that had to be brought in to quell this riot. And, of course, they have muskets, rifles, they have firepower. These guys have agreed to fight with knives and hatchets and clubs. They, in fact, agreed not to use guns because that was not considered appropriate. Artillery was used during the riot. It didn't. The heavy did not come off of ships. However, it was from cannon. He's been hit by shrapnel.
Thank you. Our people down to the docks. I want every man and woman coming off the boats given hot soup and bread. We're burying a lot of votes down here tonight.
This is a black friend of theirs who was lynched by the mob. There were
in the end
about 11 lynchings during the riot of African American men.
Know them in the dark. The city did this free of charge. Shang, Jimmy Spoils, Hellcat,
McLoyne,
and more. Friend or foe.
Or just go ahead to that last few seconds of yeah, well.
4 days and nights before the worst of the mob was finally put down. We never knew how New Yorkers died that week before the city was finally delivered. My father told me we was all born of blood and tribulation.
This is it.
And so then, too, was our great city. But for those of us who had lived and died in them furious days, it was like everything we knew was mightily swept away. And no matter what they did to build the city up again, for the rest of time, it would be like no one even knew he was ever here.
You can see in that time-lapse sequence at the end, the graveyard over in Brooklyn where both Bill Cutting, the butcher Cutting, and Amsterdam's father are buried side by side in that cemetery. And then, of course, you see this time-lapse ahead to the modern city being born, you know, being formed. But what happens in the foreground is an erasure, because the tombstones disappear, the grass grows over the graves, and what was a cemetery marking these graves passes into the past. This is part of Scorsese's metaphor for history. Okay, any...
Well, first of all, let's give...
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The rent boycott. Yeah. There's so much swirling through Irish politics at this time, and some of those movements, developments are working at cross purposes with each other. But because everybody's got their, you know, a different idea about what the end is supposed to look like, I guess typical of any reform movement. But why that period of time is so important is because it ties the Irish in America to Ireland. They raised an incredible amount of money in famine relief and for this land group as well that were trying to fight for land. So they never forgot. They never forgot that that part of it. It's interesting in Oklahoma, for example, the Choctaw Indians, who had a lot of Irish among them. A lot of the first Irish in Oklahoma came with the five civilized tribes out of the southeastern United States. When they, under the Indian Removal Bill of 1830, they were forced, not all of them, some went voluntarily, but a number, the Cherokees, had to be forcibly removed on what became known as the Trail of Tears. But the Choctaws had a lot of Irish that had intermarried within their tribe, and they moved to Oklahoma to the part of Indian Territory that was Choctaw. And they raised a lot of money for Irish famine relief. And in fact, the president of Ireland just, I think it was about 10 years ago, recognized what the Choctaws had done during that period of time. But you had Irish in Oklahoma before the land rushes, because there were Irish railroad workers who worked on the Transcontinental Railroad. Many of them stayed and married. There were Irish trappers that were part of the frontier. They may have been the first ones there. Jim Thorpe, the great Olympic athlete, his grandfather was an Irishman and married into Blackhawks, a woman from Blackhawks tribe. So you had there were Irishmen in Oklahoma before the land rushes.
Other questions or
just had a little observation. I think those federal troops were about a week off the battlefield of Gettysburg. I'm trying to imagine how those guys felt. And we just fought Gettysburg and now we've got to go this riot down. I wouldn't want to be at the other end of their guns.
Well, the riot, you talk about the draft riots?
Yeah.
Yeah. The draft, this was a fight for who was going to maintain order. Because basically the first day was a riot against the draft office. Actually, it was an enrollment office. They had to enroll every male between 20 and 45. And then once you were enrolled, you became subject to being called into service. The first day was a riot against the draft offices and all the personnel. The second day turned out to be a riot against the black workers in New York City. It was strictly Irish gangs going after either individuals that they caught in the street and executed, you know, lynched, or they went after neighborhoods, or in one case they went after an orphan asylum. 230 orphans in there. They managed to get them. Police got them out the back door. They came in and burned it to the ground. There were over 50 buildings burned to the ground during this 4 days. And then the third and fourth day basically turned out to be an attack on property, the really wealthy mansions and against the newspaper offices, the newspaper headquarters, and the editors. They blamed them. And fighting against the federal troops and the militia that came in. It got tribal right at the end. And no one knows how many people died. You know, the conservative estimate is 120. Others think that it was much higher than that. There were about 2,000 injured in it. That's right.
And
yeah.
That you get a, and I mean, it's an interesting, because anyone that's read people that have worked or other work, you know, Irish were regarded as non-whites for, you know, much of their history. So the graduation of the Irish into the core of America, then, I mean, they were fighting in the New York draft riots against the same African Americans that, frankly, they were often lumped with. I mean, you get this kind of the old problem of the drowned often have people's fingerprints on their shoulders, you know. So, I mean, that notion of fighting your way to the top, ultimately, that graveyard, you have white, Irish, and British nativists
right.
Laying side by side.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, you can read this as kind of an interesting triumph of the white race film, that in effect, ultimately, we are all buried together, kind of a Spoon River anthology done urban, where the time heals the white race, right? I mean, do you see where I'm going with
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Other comments or questions on
that? Well, when Lincoln was assassinated, and this is an incredible story. The city that had fought him on the Enrollment Act and had created this awful four-day riot and burned some major part of the city, when he died, they were the ones that responded the most with the most public show of grief. The most honor that Lincoln was given to in any of the cities that his body passed through on the way back to Springfield for burial was New York City. So it's a very curious kind of thing, and it happens very quickly. You know, they're running one on the heels of the other, as so to speak, historically. You know, as oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there were over 40 Irish regiments, close to 50 Irish regiments in the Federal Army, in the Northern Army. And they fought in substantial numbers. You know, the draft riot basically was about, number one, New York never thought they were going to be pulled into this war. They had been left alone, basically. But the Enrollment Act made it very apparent that they were part of this war. Basically, you had people who you didn't know from Adam who they were, but they were officials. They were public officials to carry out this act, and they had power. They had power over you. You had to register if you were either between 20 and 45. Even if you had applied for citizenship, you had to be enrolled. And then, of course, you had the elements of you could buy out of your, for $300, you could buy out of your draft. You could be exempted for $300.
As long as you were buying someone else's
paycheck. Yeah. Or you were allowed to buy a substitute. Which generally substitutes went for less than $300, as long as you could find somebody who was able-bodied, willing to do it, who could be trained to be a soldier, and basically the cost of a volunteer sending off a substitute to the Civil War, and there was a lot of this, was $1,500 to $1,500. And then they were paid $775 for enlisting. So for someone who had nothing or had very little, thinking that somebody's going to pay you $1,200 to go off as a substitute in the Army, and on top of that, they're going to pay you the $700 and some is a lot of money. But that was what blew up that whole $300 on the table and you're out, and the substitute thing really blew up in the face of. But what's interesting is they went through this riot, and the film captures the chaos. This is absolute chaos. Nobody's safe during this riot, no matter who you are. And after it was over, after the fires had all been put out and the dead had been buried, the draft resumed. And there was not one incident. It resumed. They got the government got the people that they needed. Lincoln got some additional soldiers for the army. They got the personnel that they needed. This is sort of, history's filled with really strange things like this. That and Lincoln's funeral cortege in New York City, you read some of the accounts, and it's just extraordinary.
Why don't we give Barry another round of applause?